This is James Throgmorton, and today I want to speak about something that I've talked about before, but it's some of the end-time things that are going to be happening, and I'll refer everybody right up front to a sermon that's already online called End-Time Prophets, and I'm going to deal with something that's very important for the end time. Because in this sermon about end time prophets, it talks about fourth chapter of the book of Malachi and the fact that God says that he's going to send Elijah the prophet back. And we certainly know that that office has been perpetuated down through time. We know that John the Baptist held that office. And here, the very last book in the Old Testament that God makes this statement. But before he makes this statement about Elijah, and the previous sermon deals with that subject, in the fourth chapter and the fourth verse, it said, "Remember the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded to him in Horeb for all Israel, with the statutes and judgment." How many of you this week have read some of the statutes and judgments in the law of Moses? You think they're important? God says that's what you need to know and remember right at this end time. "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord, and he will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to the fathers, lest I will come and strike the earth with a curse," or strike the earth with utter destruction, as some translations have. You know, turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, hearts of the children to the fathers. I remember when the Church of God, the worldwide Church of God, taught that that was the church youth program. Let me tell you what that really is. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are the fathers. The children today, the remnant of Israel, that was carried into captivity by the Assyrians, don't know who they are. When they find out who they are, the survivors, when they find out who they are, their hearts will go back to their fathers. They will know their identity. This is God actually telling us that this prophet is going to reveal to Israel their identity. Not only that, this will culminate with the return of Christ and the resurrection of the first fruits. And who are going to be there in the first fruits? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are going to get to see and meet the last generation of their descendants. Great, great, great children down into this age that they've never met, know anything about. And so the last generation of this world, as far as Israel is concerned, is going to be put back with the first generation. And that's going to be the foundation for starting the kingdom of God. That's going to be the starting place. You know, that's something that I've thought about and wondered about for years. Something I don't understand exactly how God's going to do it, but to reveal to modern day Israel who they are, their identity. And this is going to happen, and it's going to be this end time prophet that will be responsible for doing this. Now, what I want to talk about today, that's not my subject, but I want to talk about the law of Moses. And God is very specific about the law of Moses because he tells it, he says, "Remember the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded to him in Horeb for all of Israel." Which I commanded. This wasn't something Moses commanded. Moses was merely the middleman. He was the agent. The commands came from God, and here God says that, that in a future time, you needed to remember these laws, and he said in Horeb. Now, before we proceed and talk about the law of Moses, we're going to talk about where Horeb was. And we can go to the Bible and see the things that were commanded there. Now, Horeb was the mountain of God. It's where Moses saw the burning bush. It's where God had Moses to bring the children of Israel back to that point, and where God actually spoke to the children of Israel and thundered down the Ten Commandments. So we certainly know that the Ten Commandments were part of it. But we want to talk about Horeb, this mountain, because translators of the Bible, some places translated Horeb, and then the other places they take what basically Catholicism did and try to establish this Mount Horeb, the mountain of God, the one where God appeared to Moses. And Moses was in the cave and God let him see him walking away. The God that became Jesus Christ let Moses see a little bit of his back as he went away. Otherwise, it would have killed him. That cave, tradition says, and this would be Jewish tradition, that, but it makes pretty good sense that the day that God thundered that down from the mountain was the 50th day of the Feast of Weeks, Pentecost. And that makes sense. Now, the Bible doesn't say that, and I can't prove that, but it makes good sense. It's logical, and God does things logically. The Catholic Church and all of Christendom today places Horeb, the mountain of God, in the Sinai Peninsula, part of Egypt, been part of Egypt down through the centuries. And so what I want to do here before we consider about what God commanded there a little bit, and I'll only have an opportunity to barely touch the surface today, if you're really interested in it, if it means anything to you, if God says that you need to remember it at a certain point in time, and you want to take a little of your precious time and go spend to try to find out something about it, then maybe you'll do that. But what I want to establish today is an opening for you to do that, an incentive, a reason to start looking into the thing that God tells us that He wants us to do. You know, I've heard people say if they lived in Bible times, they'd sure wouldn't have any problem. If God had just speak to them, they wouldn't have any problem. You know, God spoke to the children of Israel that day, and they basically told Him, be quiet, you're hurting our ears, we give us a man to speak to us. And of course, as we can see down through time, and it's the way it is today, the people really like to listen to the fakes and the charlatans and don't like to listen to the real representatives of God. But we want to establish where this mountain was, and then we want to look at some of the things that God commanded. What did He tell Moses to teach the children of Israel? And how in the world would it apply to us today? Well, I'm going to give you several scriptures. If you'll turn back to the first chapter of the book of Exodus, and we start looking at how God called Moses. And Moses was actually, Moses and Aaron and Miriam were all raised in Pharaoh's house. We know that about Moses, but Moses was actually in line to be a Pharaoh. And I've been to Egypt, and I'm sure this is a different subject today, but I've been to the temple, burial place, or not actually, but the temple where Moses' mother was, a temple that was built to her because she actually served as Pharaoh. And again, that's a story in itself, and I don't want to get off on that subject, but Moses was in line to be Pharaoh of Egypt. When we read over in the book of Hebrews, and Moses' name's mentioned, in Hebrews it mentioned what he gave up in Pharaoh's house. And so Moses realized that he was a Hebrew, and he befriended his people, the Hebrew people, and he killed an Egyptian. We see that in the 14th verse. In the 15th verse, when Pharaoh heard of this matter, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelled in the land of Midian, and he sat down to dwell. And it goes on and tells the story of a priest of Midian had seven daughters. We don't know exactly who the Midianites were, how we could identify who they are or might be, who their descendants might be today. And that, you know, might be some important if we could understand that. But we do know one thing, that the land of Midian, I don't think there's an archaeologist or a geographic expert on the face of the earth would really admit, number one, the Sinai Peninsula, you wouldn't be able to raise sheep there. And if we'll read on in the 16th verse, we see that Moses' father-in-law had flocks and sheep, and he gave Moses a daughter to marry, Zipporah, and she had, they had a couple of children, I think, and he gave Moses a job. Moses tended his sheep. That's what Moses was doing. He was taking care of the sheep, and he was up on the mountain and saw this burning bush, you know, I guess farther up the mountain, and he went up there and it talked to him. It was on this mountain. It's very important that we understand that it was on this mountain. It's important that we understand where it was. So in the third chapter of Exodus, it says Moses was tending his flocks, and his father-in-law's flocks. He came to Horeb, the mountain of God. So that's the name of the mountain of God. And as you go through your Bible, you'll find that the translators here translated it correctly, but you get to other parts of the Bible and they put Sinai in there, Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai, as far as the Bible's concerned, is totally irrelevant, unimportant. Horeb is important. If we come down into the 11th verse, we'll find that God has told Moses that he wants him to go back to Egypt and bring the children of Israel out of captivity. Moses says to God in the 11th verse, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?" He said, "I will certainly be with you," God tells him this, "and this is the sign that to you that I have sent you. When you have brought the children out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain." So God tells him right then to go bring the children of Israel back to that mountain. Now, if you'll turn on over to the fourth chapter, I just want to make a point here. And the Eternal said unto Moses, "When you go back to Egypt, see that you do all those wonders before Pharaoh, which I have put in your hand. But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go." Do you notice what he said in the 21st verse? Simple little thing. It's a subtle little thing. When you go back to Egypt, you wouldn't say that if he was at Mount Sinai that was already in Egypt. I'm not going to stand here and say that I'm going to go back to Poplar Bluff when I'm standing in Poplar Bluff. Simple little thing. God tells him to go back to Egypt. So Mount Horeb was not in Egypt. It's not in Egypt today. Nobody knows exactly where it is. Most likely, it's over in the area where Saudi Arabia is. But as far as knowing, I don't think anybody really does. Now, let's go back to our original subject a little bit about what God's told us in Malachi. "Remember the law of Moses, which I commanded in Horeb, with all the statutes and the judgments." And so let's see, where would we find that? Come on over to Exodus, the 20th chapter. And this is something that we need to understand, that this is what God told the people on that day. And it's the Ten Commandments. You know, the Ten Commandments is, as far as the law of God is concerned, the Ten Commandments are like the Constitution of the United States. I'm going to make a comparison. The Constitution of the United States, the Ten Commandments, and the statutes and judgments. The way our legal system is supposed to work, unfortunately, it doesn't work anymore. because man has corrupted things. It's the same principle with the statutes and the judgment. The Ten Commandments are like the Constitution of the United States. They're the foundational doctrine. This is the thing that God directly told the children of Israel. And, you know, there's a lot of controversy about the Ten Commandments and various things. And irregardless, most of the people that pretend to keep them sure don't keep the fourth one. Thieves don't keep the one that says, thou shalt not steal. And adulterers don't keep the ones that says, thou shalt not commit adultery. And murderers don't keep the one that says, thou shalt not murder. Idolaters don't keep the one that says, you shall have no other gods before me, and don't bow down and worship idols. And so, as far as the Bible's concerned, it doesn't number them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. That's something that, but this is the Constitution of God, if you want to look at it. And then there are statutes and judgments, and that's the same in the modern legal system. And it was based, English common law, which basically came from the Bible. That concept is biblical concepts. In fact, a lot of the law of Moses is the foundation of those things. There was the statutes and the judgments. Now, Congress, or it could be, if it's a state law, it could be the state legislature, they passed statutes. And then the judicial system, the judges make decisions in specific cases that become the judgments. And so, you know, in the legal system, and you see Matlock and all these TV attorneys that'll do that, they'll quote a precedent where a judge has previously made a decision based on this particular law, and the judge in the courtroom will uphold it and everything, because once a judgment is made and it's an official judgment, it actually in effect becomes like a law. And so when we go back to the law of Moses, it's no different. It's the same system, because that's actually where it started. This is the origin of where it started. God laid out some rules and regulation before he thundered down the law himself. He made them wait about 3 days and told them all sorts of things that they needed to do. They needed to wash their clothes, and then they had Moses had boundaries set to the mountains where the people could only go so close, because God was going to appear there in his glory, and God didn't want to kill a bunch of them. He was going to appear in the cloud. He wasn't going to appear in his glory, in his pure spiritual state, but put on a performance for him that day. First off, part of what he commanded at Horeb that we're supposed to remember, he set up some rules and regulations. You know, that's something that people don't understand about God. As human beings, we all like our independence and our freedom, and as Americans, we like it and appreciate it even more. God offers complete freedom, but he does have some provisions that are very important. Why do you think he didn't had Moses set boundaries and didn't want them to go up further on the mountain? Because he didn't want them to get hurt. People say of the commandments of God, well, they're all don'ts. Don't do this. Don't do that. No. They say, don't do it. God tells us, don't do this. Don't commit adultery, because if you do, you're going to get hurt. You're going to hurt somebody. Don't murder, because you're going to hurt somebody. And so after God gets through with this, he tells the children of Israel, choose you this day blessings or cursings. You keep the law, you'll be blessed. You break the law, you'll be cursed. You break the boundary line that I've set today, and you go up past the boundary line, chances are you're going to get hurt. And that's what the law of God is. It's God saying, don't walk out in the road in front of a Mack truck. It'll kill you. That's all it is. God's law protects us. It doesn't hurt us. It doesn't take away our freedom. It gives us total freedom, complete freedom, because it keeps us from getting hurt. Now, In the 21st chapter of Exodus, Moses starts off, and we won't have time. I'm just going to have a time to just give a glimpse of this because it's important. Immediately it says, these are the judgments which you shall set before them. So he starts listing things that are judgments based on the overall concept of the commandments. And if you look at these, it starts dealing with servitude, slavery, which in this day and generation is a hard thing to understand. And I don't want to get off on that subject, but ancient Israel had a system of servitude that was their welfare system. It worked. You know, I heard this the other day, and I think I'd heard it in the past, but it was Benjamin Franklin, I think, that said it. If you want to help somebody that's poor, make them uncomfortable in their poverty, and they'll get out of it. Don't make them a perpetual poor person. Try to get people out of it. And God's system for that, and the first thing, because if somebody couldn't handle their personal affair, they could sell themselves into servitude, into slavery if you want. Now God's system in verse 2 begins to deal with this and says, now they can only do this for 6 years because in the seventh year they go free. They get to go back and try it, but their debts and all their everything's wiped out. And then he goes through and he makes some rules, and it's better than welfare because God had restraints on. And this is really a type of something else, because all of us that have been called of God and have repented had to come to a point in our lives to realize, we may not fully realize it then, but I hope we realize it now, that as far as God was concerned and what God expects of us, we were utter failures in our lives. That's what repentance and baptism is all about. In fact, we had to tell Jesus Christ when we were baptized, I have failed. I need you to pay my way out of debt, because you had the death penalty hanging over your head. All of us did. All human beings do. And so Christ bought us for a price. He paid for us, got us free, and we become His bond servants. All this was a type. Again, proof of the Bible, proof of how brilliant God is, how fair and how just. And I'm just mentioning that point because that's the first thing He deals with. He deals with divorce. He deals with somebody that digs a pit and another man's ox falls in it. Or He deals with an animal that attacks another human being. You can read this. What do you do when you got a dog that attacks a child? What do you do with the chimpanzee that tears the woman's face off? Tells you what to do with it. What do you do with a murderer? And you know, that's the way people look at it. They look at it from a human perspective. They make the same mistake that Adam and Eve made in the garden and take for themselves the knowledge of good and evil and say, I can improve on God's system. I want to ask you a question. I asked the people, Pocahontas, this question yesterday, because God really deals with this thing very fairly. He deals with it fair. What if you catch somebody in the very act of murdering somebody? There's no doubt that they murdered them, and it was a death sentence. And how were they executed? You know, in this society, we have the arguments over whether capital punishment is cruel and unusual punishment, or whether somebody gets sentenced to death. They go for years and years and years and years and may never be executed. We have recent times, we've heard a lot about how the United States of America had treated some of the terrorists and how they had, according to their terminology, tortured them. I want to ask you a question. Think about it. Which would you choose? If you had to choose an ordeal, which would you rather be? Had you rather be waterboarded, or would you rather be stoned to death? You'd rather hang or be stoned to death? You'd rather be shot or stoned to death? You'd rather have a lethal injection or stoned to death? You'd rather have the gas chamber or be stoned to death? I think you'd pick any of them before you'd pick being stoned to death. Can you think of a more miserable, agonizing way to die than to be stoned to death? Yet God says that's justice. That's what He says. But, you know, Adam and Eve are smarter than God. They know what's best. And mankind is coming to the point where Adam and Eve's descendants are going to find out they made the wrong choice, that man is not capable of ruling himself. And God says, you better go back and remember how I told you to do it in the first place. And there's exceptions. Man accused of murder can flee to the Levitical city. And I don't want to get off on the details of the subject. It says an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand and a foot for a foot. And it's dealing with somebody with a certain attitude. We get these terrible killers, people that do terrible things. And God mainly says, if this is their mindset, you give back to them just exactly what they gave out. You know, a little of that go on. I'm not talking for people that are accused. God's law, Keith and I were talking about this not long ago. God's law requires two credible witnesses. Absolute credible witnesses. Christ was executed contrary to the law because He didn't have any witnesses. They had to bribe somebody. And that takes place in our legal system today. You know, there's another interesting one here that I think really, and like I say, I can't even touch the surface today in this sermon. But there's one that is so fair. Say a man has got two oxen, and I don't think any of us have ever had a lot of experience with oxen. I certainly know I haven't, and I don't have to worry about this, and that's something we need to understand about the law of Moses. There's certain laws that are not applicable. If you don't have any servants, then those laws are not applicable to you. If you don't dig a pit, you don't have to worry about the penalty of somebody falling in it. And if you go out and dig a pit, you need to make sure that they can't fall in it. But say you and your neighbor have a couple of oxen that are real wild characters, and they get in a fight, and one of them gores the other oxen, and he dies. What do you do about it? Well, the ones left alive, God says, you sell them and you divide the money. Justice. Real justice. That's what God's law does. You know, it's like the Progressive insurance ad on television. I get a kick out of it because they're going through a tour of the place. I'm sure most of you have seen it. Weasley little guy back there says, well, what if Mom won't let me drive? The woman says, well, if you don't drive, you most likely won't have an accident. The same principle is here. If it's applicable to what you're doing, then the law covers it. You know, person that doesn't own an automobile, never drives, the speed limit doesn't affect them at all, personally. And so it deals with every aspect of the law of God. Now, you won't find it. It's in the Bible, but you won't find it all in one place in the Bible. You're going to have to look through Exodus and Numbers and Deuteronomy and get a lot of principles. It's not something that's easy. But you need to have these concepts in your mind. You don't need what the news media tells you or what modern society tells you is correct. You need to get your concepts of right and wrong from the law of God. Because if you've got that, you won't be making the same mistake that Adam and Eve made. You won't be taking to yourself the knowledge of good and evil. So basically, what's this prophet Elijah going to come back and do? He's going to come back and show Israel its identity, who it really is. And then he's going to say that you need to listen to God and let God decide what's right and wrong. Don't you ever try to decide yourself what's right and wrong. And we do that as human beings. We do that. We can't help that. But we need to realize that we're not qualified to make that decision. And the people that make it in the first resurrection and are there to reign and rule with Christ are going to be the ones that have come to the total realization that they're incapable of doing it, and they're going to, whatever God says to do, they're going to say, yes, sir, I'm doing it. This has been James Throckmorton speaking to you for the Churches of God.